the situation. We felt all that, Joe and I, without saying a word to each other. We just stood there and listened with a murderous, silent contempt. And as soon as we could break away, we did so. We left him there at the bar, blubbering to himself over his Pernod. Once out of his sight, we began to laugh hysterically. The false teeth. No matter what we said about the poor devil, and we said some good things about him too, we always came back to the false teeth. There are people in this world who cut such a grotesque figure that even death renders them ridiculous. And the more horrible the death, the more ridiculous they seem. It's no use trying to invest the end with a little dignity. You have to be a liar and a hypocrite to discover anything tragic in their going. And since we didn't have to put on a false front, we could laugh about the incident to our heart's content. We laughed all night about it. And in between times, we vented our scorn and disgust for the guys upstairs, the fatheads who were trying to persuade themselves, no doubt, that Peckover was a fine fellow and that his death was a catastrophe. All sorts of funny recollections came to our minds. The semicolons that he overlooked and for which they bawled the piss out of him. They made his life miserable with their fucking little semicolons and the fractions which he always got wrong. They were even going to fire him once because he came to work with a boozy breath. They despised him because he always looked so miserable and because he had eczema and dandruff. He was just a nobody as far as they were concerned. But now that he was dead, they would all chip in lustily and buy him a huge wreath. And they'd put his name in big type in the obituary column. Anything to throw a little reflection on themselves. They'd make him out to be a big shit if they could. But unfortunately, with Peckover, there was little they could invent about him. He was a zero, and even the fact that he was dead wouldn't add a cipher to his name. "There's only one good aspect to it," says Joe. "You may get his job, and if you have any luck, maybe you'll fall down the elevator shaft and break your neck, too. We'll buy you a nice wreath, I promise you that." Toward dawn, we are sitting on the terrace of the dome. We've forgotten about poor Peckover long ago. We've had a little excitement at the Bal Nègre, and Joe's mind has slipped back to the eternal preoccupation. Cunt. It's at this hour, when his night off is almost concluded, that his restlessness mounts to a fever pitch. He thinks of the women he passed up earlier in the evening, and of the steady ones he might have had for the asking, if it weren't that he was fed up with them. He is reminded inevitably of his Georgia cunt. She's been hounding him lately, begging him to take her in, at least until she can find herself a job. "I don't mind giving her a feed once in a while," he says, "but I couldn't take her on as a steady thing. She'd ruin it for my other cunts." What gripes him most about her is that she doesn't put on any flesh. "It's like taking a skeleton to bed with you," he says. "The other night I took her on, out of pity. And what do you think the crazy bitch had done to herself? She had shaved it clean, not a speck of hair on it. Did you ever have a woman who shaved her twat? It's repulsive, ain't it? And it's funny, too, sort of mad-like. It doesn't look like a twat anymore. It's like a dead clam or something." He describes to me how, his curiosity aroused, he got out of bed and searched for his flashlight. "I made her hold it open and I trained the flashlight on it. You should have seen me. It was comical. I got so worked up about it that I forgot all about her. I never in my life looked at a cunt so seriously. You'd imagine I'd never seen one before. And the more I looked at it, the less interesting it became. It only goes to show that there's nothing to it after all, especially when it's shaved. It's the hair that makes it mysterious. That's why a statue leaves you cold. Only once I saw a real cunt on a statue. That was by Rodin. You ought to see it sometime. She has her legs spread wide apart. I don't think there was any head on it. Just a cunt, you might say. Jesus, it looked ghastly. The thing is, they all look alike. When you look at them with their clothes on, you imagine all sorts of things. You give them an individuality, like, which they haven't got, of course. There's just a crack there between the legs, and you get all steamed up about it. You don't even look at it half the time. You know it's there, and all you think about is getting your ramrod inside. It's as though your penis did the thinking for you. It's an illusion. You get all burned up about nothing. about a crack with hair on it, or without hair. It's so absolutely meaningless that it fascinated me to look at it. I must have studied it for 10 minutes or more. When you look at it that way, sort of detached-like, you get funny notions in your head. All that mystery about sex, and then you discover that it's nothing, just a blank. Wouldn't it be funny if you found a harmonica inside, or a calendar? But there's nothing there, nothing at all. It's disgusting. It almost drove me mad. Listen, do you know what I did afterwards? I gave her a quick lay, and then I turned my back on her. Yeah, I picked up a book and I read. You can get something out of a book, even a bad book. But a cunt? It's just sheer loss of time. It just so happened that as he was concluding this speech, a whore gave us the eye. Without the slightest transition, he says to me abruptly, "Would you like to give her a tumble? It won't cost much. She'll take the two of us on." And without waiting for a reply, he staggers to his feet and goes over to her. In a few minutes, he comes back. "It's all fixed," he says. "Finish your beer. She's hungry. There's nothing doing anymore at this hour. She'll take the both of us for 15 francs. We'll go to my room. It'll be cheaper." End of side 7. Side 8. On the way to the hotel, the girl is shivering so that we have to stop and buy her a coffee. She's a rather gentle sort of creature and not at all bad to look at. She evidently knows Van Norden, knows there's nothing to expect from him but the 15 francs. "You haven't got any dough," he says, mumbling to me under his breath. As I haven't a centime in my pocket, I don't quite see the point of this, until he bursts out, "For Christ's sakes, remember that we're broke. Don't get tender-hearted when we get upstairs. She's going to ask you for a little extra. I know this cunt. I could get her for 10 francs if I wanted to. There's no use spoiling them."
"Il est méchant, celui-là,"
she says to me, gathering the drift of his remarks in her dull way.
"Non, il n'est pas méchant. Il est très gentil."
She shakes her head laughingly.
"Je le connais bien, ce type."
And then she commences a hard luck story about the hospital and the back rent and the baby in the country. But she doesn't overdo it. She knows that our ears are stopped. But the misery is there inside her, like a stone, and there's no room for any other thoughts. She isn't trying to make an appeal to our sympathies. She She's just shifting this big weight inside her from one place to another. I rather like her. I hope to Christ she hasn't got a disease. In the room, she goes about her preparations mechanically. There isn't a crust of bread about by any chance? She inquires as she squats over the bidet. Van Norden laughs at this. Here, take a drink, he says, shoving a bottle at her. She doesn't want anything to drink. Her stomach's already on the bum, she complains. That's just a line with her, says Van Norden. Don't let her work on your sympathies. Just the same, I wish she'd talk about something else. How the hell can you get up any passion when you got a starving cunt on your hands? Precisely. We haven't any passion, either of us. And as for her, one might as well expect her to produce a diamond necklace as to show a spark of passion. But there's the 15 francs, and something has to be done about it. It's like a state of war. The moment the condition is precipitated, nobody thinks about anything but peace, about getting it over with. And yet, nobody has the courage to lay down his arms, to say, I'm fed up with it, I'm through. No, there's 15 francs somewhere, which nobody gives a damn about anymore, and which nobody is going to get in the end anyhow. But the 15 francs is like the primal cause of things. And rather than listen to one's own voice, rather than walk out on the primal cause, one surrenders to the situation. One goes on butchering and butchering. And the more cowardly one feels, the more heroically does he behave. Until a day when the bottom drops out, and suddenly all the guns are silenced, and the stretcher-bearers pick up the maimed and bleeding heroes and pin medals on their chests. Then one has the rest of his life to think about the 15 francs. One hasn't any eyes or arms or legs, but he has the consolation of dreaming for the rest of his days about the 15 francs, which everybody has forgotten. It's exactly like a state of war. I can't get it out of my head. The way she works over me, to blow a spark of passion into me, makes me think what a damned poor soldier I'd be if I was ever silly enough to be trapped like this and dragged to the front. I know for my part that I'd surrender everything, honor included, in order to get out of the mess. I haven't any stomach for it, and that's all there is to it. But she's got her mind set on the 15 francs, and if I don't want to fight about it, she's going to make me fight. But you can't put fight into a man's guts if he hasn't any fight in him. There are some of us so cowardly that you can't ever make heroes of us, not even if you frighten us to death. We know too much, maybe. There are some of us who don't live in the moment, who live a little ahead or a little behind. My mind is on the peace treaty all the time. I can't forget that it was the 15 francs which started all the trouble. 15 francs! What does 15 francs mean to me, particularly since it's not my 15 francs? Van Norden seems to have a more normal attitude about it. He doesn't care a rap about the 15 francs either now. It's the situation itself which intrigues him. It seems to call for a show of mettle. His manhood is involved. The 15 francs are lost, whether we succeed or not. There's something more involved. Not just manhood, perhaps, but will. It's like a man in the trenches again. He doesn't know anymore why he should go on living, because if he escapes now, he'll only be caught later. But he goes on just the same, and even though he has the soul of a cockroach and has admitted as much to himself, give him a gun or a knife or even just his bare nails, and he'll go on slaughtering and slaughtering. He'd slaughter a million men rather than stop and ask himself why. As I watch Van Norden tackle her, it seems to me that I'm looking at a machine whose cogs have slipped. Left to themselves, they could go on this way forever, grinding and slipping, without ever anything happening, until a hand shuts the motor off. The sight of them, coupled like a pair of goats, without the least spark of passion, grinding and grinding away for no reason except the 15 francs, washes away every bit of feeling I have, except the inhuman one of satisfying my curiosity. The girl is lying on the edge of the bed, and Van Norden is bent over her like a satyr with his 2 feet solidly planted on the floor. I am sitting on a chair behind him, watching their movements with a cool, scientific detachment. It doesn't matter to me if it should last forever. It's like watching one of those crazy machines which throw the newspaper out. Millions and billions and trillions of them, with their meaningless headlines. The machine seems more sensible, crazy as it is, and more fascinating to watch than the human beings and the events which produced it. My interest in Van Norden and the girl is nil. If I could sit like this and watch every single performance going on at this minute all over the world, my interest would be even less than nil. I wouldn't be able to differentiate between this phenomenon and the rain falling or a volcano erupting. As long as that spark of passion is missing, there is no human significance in the performance. The machine is better to watch. And these two are like a machine which has slipped its cogs. It needs the touch of a human hand to set it right. It needs a mechanic. I get down on my knees behind Van Norden, and I examine the machine more attentively. The girl throws her head to one side and gives me a despairing look. "It's no use," she says. "It's impossible." Upon which Van Norden sets to work with renewed energy, just like an old billy goat. He's such an obstinate cuss that he'll break his horns rather than give up. And he's getting sore now because I'm tickling him in the rump. "For God's sake, Joe, give it up. You'll kill the poor girl." "Leave me alone," he grunts. "I almost got it in that time." The posture and the determined way in which he blurts this out suddenly bring to my mind for the second time the remembrance of my dream. Only now, it seems as though that broomstick, which he had so nonchalantly slung under his arm as he walked away, is lost forever. It is like the sequel to the dream, the same Van Norden, but minus the primal cause. He's like a hero come back from the war, a poor maimed bastard living out the reality of his dreams. Wherever he sits himself, the chair collapses. Whatever door he enters, the room is empty. Whatever he puts in his mouth leaves a bad taste. Everything is just the same as it was before. The elements are unchanged. The dream is no different than the reality. Only between the time he went to sleep and the time he woke up, his body was stolen. He's like a machine throwing out newspapers, millions and billions of them every day, and the front page is loaded with catastrophes, with riots, murders, explosions, collisions. But he doesn't feel anything. If somebody doesn't turn the switch off, he'll never know what it means to die. You can't die if your own proper body has been stolen. You can get over a cunt and work away like a billy goat until eternity. You can go to the trenches and be blown to bits. Nothing will create that spark of passion if there isn't the intervention of a human hand. Somebody has to put his hand into the machine and let it be wrenched off if the cogs are to mesh again. Somebody has to do this without hope of reward, without concern over the 15 francs. Somebody whose chest is so thin that a medal would make him hunchbacked. And somebody has to throw a feed into a starving cunt without fear of pushing it out again. Otherwise, this show will go on forever. There's no way out of the mess. After sucking the boss's ass for a whole week, it's the thing to do here, I managed to land Peckover's job. He died all right, the poor devil, a few hours after he hit the bottom of the shaft. And just as I predicted, they gave him a fine funeral, with solemn mass, huge wreaths, and everything. Tout compris. And after the ceremonies, they regaled themselves, the upstairs guys, at a bistro. It was too bad Peckover couldn't have had just a little snack. He would have appreciated it so much to sit with the men upstairs and hear his own name mentioned so frequently. I must say right at the start that I haven't a thing to complain about. It's like being in a lunatic asylum, with permission to masturbate for the rest of your life. The world is brought right under my nose, and all that is requested of me is to punctuate the calamities. There is nothing in which these slick guys upstairs do not put their fingers. No joy, no misery passes unnoticed. They live among the hard facts of life, reality as it is called. It is the reality of a swamp, and they are the frogs who have nothing better to do than to croak. The more they croak, the more real life becomes. Lawyer, priest, doctor, politician, newspaper man. These are the quacks who have their fingers on the pulse of the world. A constant atmosphere of calamity. It's marvelous. It's as if the barometer never changed, as if the flag were always at half-mast. One can see now how the idea of heaven takes hold of men's consciousness, how it gains ground even when all the props have been knocked from under it. There must be another world beside this swamp in which everything is dumped pell-mell. It's hard to imagine what it can be like, this heaven that men dream about. A frog's heaven, no doubt. Miasma, scum, pond lilies, stagnant water. Sit on a lily pad, unmolested, and croak all day. Something like that, I imagine. They have a wonderful therapeutic effect upon me, these catastrophes which I proofread. Imagine a state of perfect immunity, a charmed existence, a life of absolute security in the midst of poison bacilli. Nothing touches me, neither earthquakes, nor explosions, nor riots, nor famine, nor collisions, nor wars, nor revolutions. I am inoculated against every disease, every calamity, every sorrow and misery. It is the culmination of a life of fortitude. Seated at my little niche, all the poisons which the world gives off each day pass through my hands. Not even a fingernail gets stained. I am absolutely immune. I am even better off than a laboratory attendant, because there are no bad odors here, just the smell of lead burning. The world can blow up. I'll be here just the same to put in a comma or a semicolon. I may even touch a little overtime, for with an event like that, there's bound to be a final extra. When the world blows up and the final edition has gone to press, the proofreaders will quietly gather up all commas, semicolons, hyphens, asterisks, brackets, parentheses, periods, exclamation marks, etc., and put them in a little box over the editorial chair. Comme ça, tout est réglé. None of my companions seem to understand why I appear so contented. They grumble all the time. They have ambitions. They want to show their pride and spleen. A good proofreader has no ambitions, no pride, no spleen. A good proofreader is a little like God Almighty. He's in the world, but not of it. He's for Sundays only. Sunday is his night off. On Sundays, he steps down from his pedestal and shows his ass to the faithful. Once a week, he listens in on all the private grief and misery of the world. It's enough to last him for the rest of the week. The rest of the week, he remains in the frozen winter marshes, an absolute, an impeccable absolute, with only a vaccination mark to distinguish him from the immense void. The greatest calamity for a proofreader is the threat of losing his job. When we get together in the break, the question that sends a shiver down our spines is, what'll you do if you lose your job? For the man in the paddock, whose duty it is to sweep up manure, the supreme terror is the possibility of a world without horses. To tell him that it is disgusting to spend one's life shoveling up hot turds is a piece of imbecility. A man can get to love shit if his livelihood depends on it, if his happiness is involved. The life which, if I were still a man with pride, honor, ambition, and so forth, would seem like the bottom rung of degradation, I welcome now, as an invalid welcomes death. It's a negative reality, just like death, a sort of heaven without the pain and terror of dying. In this Chthonian world, the only thing of importance is orthography and punctuation. It doesn't matter what the nature of the calamity is, only whether it is spelled right. Everything is on one level, whether it be the latest fashion for evening gowns, a new battleship, a plague, a high explosive, an astronomic discovery, a bank run, a railroad wreck, a bull market, 100-to-1 shot, an execution, a stick-up, an assassination, or what? Nothing escapes the proofreader's eye. but nothing penetrates his bulletproof vest. To the Hindu Agamir, Madame Shear, formerly Mrs. Stev, writes saying she is quite satisfied with his work. I was married June 6th, and I thank you. We are very happy, and I hope that thanks to your power, it will be so forever. I am sending you by telegraph money order the sum of to reward you. The Hindu Agamir foretells your fortune and reads all your thoughts in a precise and inexplicable way. He will advise you, will help you rid yourself of your worries and troubles of all kinds, etc. Call or write 20 Avenue MacMahon, Paris. He reads all your thoughts in a marvelous way. I take it that means without exception, from the most trivial thoughts to the most shameless. He must have a lot of time on his hands, this Agamir. Or does he only concentrate on the thoughts of those who send money by telegraph money order? In the same edition, I notice a headline announcing that the universe is expanding so fast it may burst, and underneath it is the photograph of a splitting headache. And then there is a spiel about the pearl, signed Tekla. The oyster produces both, he informs all and sundry, both the wild or oriental pearl and the cultured pearl. On the same day, at the Cathedral of Trier, the Germans are exhibiting the coat of Christ. It's the first time it's been taken out of the mothballs in 42 years. Nothing said about the pants and vest. In Salzburg, also the same day, two mice were born in a man's stomach, believe it or not. A famous movie actress is shown with her legs crossed. She is taking a rest in Hyde Park. And underneath, a well-known painter remarks, I'll admit that Mrs. Coolidge has such charm and personality that she would have been one of the 12 famous Americans, even had her husband not been president. From an interview with Mr. Humhal of Vienna, I glean the following. Before I stop, said Mr. Humhal, I'd like to say that faultless cut and fit does not suffice. The proof of good tailoring is seen in the wearing. A suit must bend to the body, yet keep its line when the wearer is walking or sitting. And wherever there is an explosion in a coal mine, a British coal mine, notice, please, that the king and queen always send their condolences promptly by telegraph. And they always attend the important races, though the other day, according to the copy, it was at the Derby, I believe, heavy rains began to fall, much to the surprise of the king and queen. More heartrending, however, is an item like this. It is claimed in Italy that the persecutions are not against the church, but nevertheless they are conducted against the most exquisite parts of the church. It is claimed that they are not against the Pope, but they are against the very heart and eyes of the Pope. I had to travel precisely all around the world to find just such a comfortable, agreeable niche as this. It seems incredible almost. How could I have foreseen in America, with all those firecrackers they put up your ass to give you pep and courage, that the ideal position for a man of my temperament was to look for orthographic mistakes? Over there, you think of nothing but becoming President of the United States someday. Potentially, every man is presidential timber. Here, it is different. Here, every man is potentially a zero. If you become something or somebody, it is an accident, a miracle. The chances are 1,000 to 1 that you will never leave your native village. The chances are 1,000 to 1 that you'll have your legs shot off or your eyes blown out. Unless the miracle happens, and you find yourself a general or a rear admiral. But it's just because the chances are all against you, just because there is so little hope, that life is sweet over here. Day by day, no yesterdays and no tomorrows. The barometer never changes. The flag is always at half-mast. You wear a piece of black crepe on your arm. You have a little ribbon in your buttonhole. And, if you were lucky enough to afford it, you buy yourself a pair of artificial lightweight limbs, aluminum preferably, which does not prevent you from enjoying an aperitif, or looking at the animals in the zoo, or flirting with the vultures who sail up and down the boulevards, always on the alert for fresh carrion. Time passes. If you're a stranger and your papers are in order, you can expose yourself to infection without fear of being contaminated. It is better, if possible, to have a proofreader's job. Comme ça, tout s'arrange. That means that if you happen to be strolling home at 3 in the morning and you are intercepted by the bicycle cops, you can snap your fingers at them. In the morning, when the market is in swing, you can buy Belgian eggs at 50 centimes apiece. A proofreader doesn't get up usually until noon or a little after. It's well to choose a hotel near a cinema, because if you have a tendency to oversleep, the bells will wake you up in time for the matinee. Or, if you can't find a hotel near a cinema, choose one near a cemetery. It comes to the same thing. Above all, never despair. Il ne faut jamais désespérer. Which is what I try to din into Carl and Van Norden every night. A world without hope, but no despair. It's as though I had been converted to a new religion. As though I were making an annual novena every night to Our Lady of Solace. I can't imagine what there would be to gain if I were made editor of the paper, or even president of the United States. I'm up a blind alley, and it's cozy and comfortable. With a piece of copy in my hand, I listen to the music around me, the hum and drone of voices, the tinkle of the linotype machines, as if there were 1,000 silver bracelets passing through a ringer. Now and then a rat scurries past our feet, or a cockroach descends the wall in front of us, moving nimbly and gingerly on his delicate legs. The events of the day are slid under your nose, quietly, unostentatiously, with now and then a byline to mark the presence of a human hand, an ego, a touch of vanity. The procession passes serenely, like a cortege entering the cemetery gates. The paper under the copy desk is so thick that it almost feels like a carpet with a soft nap. Under Van Norden's desk, it is stained with brown juice. Around 11 o'clock, the peanut vendor arrives, a half-wit of an Armenian who is also content with his lot in life. Now and then, I get a cablegram from Mona, saying that she's arriving on the next boat. Letter following, it always says. It's been going on like this for 9 months, but I never see her name in the list of boat arrivals. Nor does the garçon ever bring me a letter on a silver platter. I haven't any more expectations in that direction either. If ever she does arrive, she can look for me downstairs, just behind the lavatory. She'll probably tell me right away that it's unsanitary. That's the first thing that strikes an American woman about Europe, that it's unsanitary. Impossible for them to conceive of a paradise without modern plumbing. If they find a bed bug, they want to write a letter immediately to the Chamber of Commerce. How am I ever going to explain to her that I'm contented here? She'll say I've become a degenerate. I know her line from beginning to end. She'll want to look for a studio with a garden attached, and a bathtub to be sure. She wants to be poor in a romantic way. I know her, but I'm prepared for her this time. There are days, nevertheless, when the sun is out, when I get off the beaten path and think about her hungrily. Now and then, despite my grim satisfaction, I get to thinking about another way of life, get to wondering if it would make a difference having a young, restless creature by my side. The trouble is, I can hardly remember what she looks like, nor even how it feels to have my arms around her. Everything that belongs to the past seems to have fallen into the sea. I have memories, but the images have lost their vividness. They seem dead and desultory, like time-bitten mummies stuck in a quagmire. If I try to recall my life in New York, I get a few splintered fragments, nightmarish and covered with verdigris. It seems as if my own proper existence had come to an end somewhere. Just where exactly, I can't make out. I'm not an American anymore, nor a New Yorker, and even less a European or a Parisian. I haven't any allegiance, any responsibilities, any hatreds, any worries, any prejudices, any passion. I'm neither for nor against. I'm a neutral. When we walk home of a night, the three of us, it often happens, after the first spasms of disgust, that we get to talking about the condition of things, with that enthusiasm which only those who bear no active part in life can muster. What seems strange to me sometimes, when I crawl into bed, is that all this enthusiasm is engendered just to kill time, just to annihilate the 3/4 of an hour which it requires to walk from the office to Montparnasse. We might have the most brilliant, the most feasible ideas for the amelioration of this or that, but there is no vehicle to hitch them to. And what is more strange is that the absence of any relationship between ideas and living causes us no anguish, no discomfort. We have become so adjusted that if tomorrow we were ordered to walk on our hands, we would do so without the slightest protest, provided, of course, that the paper came out as usual and that we touched our pay regularly. Otherwise, nothing matters. Nothing. We have become orientalized. We have become coolies, white-collar coolies, silenced by a handful of rice each day. A special feature in American skulls, I was reading the other day, is the presence of the epacto bone, or os inci, in the occiput. The presence of this bone, so the savant went on to say, is due to a persistence of the transverse occipital suture, which is usually closed in fetal life. Hence, it is a sign of arrested development and indicative of an inferior race. The average cubical capacity of the American skull, so it went on to say, falls below that of the white and rises above that of the black race. Taking both sexes, the Parisians of today have a cranial capacity of 1,448 cubic centimeters. The Negroes, 1,344 centimeters. The American Indians, 1,376. From all of which I deduce nothing, because I am an American and not an Indian. But it's cute to explain things that way, by a bone, an os inci, for example. It doesn't disturb his theory at all to admit that single examples of Indian skulls have yielded the extraordinary capacity of 1,920 cubic centimeters, a cranial capacity not exceeded in any other race. What I note with satisfaction is that the Parisians of both sexes seem to have a normal cranial capacity. The transverse occipital suture is evidently not so persistent with them. They know how to enjoy an aperitif, and they don't worry if the houses are unpainted. There's nothing extraordinary about their skulls, so far as cranial indices go. There must be some other explanation for the art of living which they have brought to such a degree of perfection. At Monsieur Paul's, the bistro across the way, there is a back room reserved for the newspaper men, where we can eat on credit. It is a pleasant little room with sawdust on the floor and flies in season and out. When I say that it is reserved for the newspaper men, I don't mean to imply that we eat in privacy. On the contrary, it means that we have the privilege of associating with the whores and pimps who form the more substantial element of Monsieur Paul's clientele. The arrangement suits the guys upstairs to a T, because they're always on the lookout for tail. And even those who have a steady little French girl are not averse to making a switch now and then. The principal thing is not to get a dose. At times it would seem as if an epidemic had swept the office. Or perhaps it might be explained by the fact that they all sleep with the same woman. Anyhow, it's gratifying to observe how miserable they can look when they're obliged to sit beside a pimp who, despite the little hardships of his profession, lives a life of luxury by comparison. I'm thinking particularly now of one tall, blonde fellow who delivers the Havas messages by bicycle. He is always a little late for his meal, always perspiring profusely and his face covered with grime. He has a fine, awkward way of strolling in, saluting everybody with two fingers, and making a beeline for the sink, which is just between the toilet and the kitchen. As he wipes his face, he gives the edibles a quick inspection. If he sees a nice steak lying on the slab, he picks it up and sniffs it. Or he will dip the ladle into the big pot and try a mouthful of soup. He's like a fine bloodhound, his nose to the ground all the time. The preliminary's over, having made pee-pee and blown his nose vigorously, he walks nonchalantly over to his wench and gives her a big smacking kiss, together with an affectionate pat on the rump. Her, the wench, I've never seen look anything but immaculate, even at 3 a.m., after an evening's work. She looks exactly as if she had just stepped out of a Turkish bath. It's a pleasure to look at such healthy brutes, to see such repose, such affection, such appetite as they display. It's the evening meal I'm speaking of now, the little snack that she takes before entering upon her duties. In a little while, she will be obliged to take leave of her big blonde brute, to flop somewhere on the boulevard and sip her digestif. If the job is irksome or wearing or exhaustive, she certainly doesn't show it. When the big fellow arrives, hungry as a wolf, she puts her arms around him and kisses him hungrily. His eyes, nose, cheeks, hair, the back of his neck, she'd kiss his ass if it could be done publicly. She's grateful to him, that's evident. She's no wage slave. All through the meal, she laughs convulsively. You wouldn't think she had a care in the world. And now and then, by way of affection, she gives him a resounding slap in the face, such a whack as would knock a proofreader spinning. They don't seem to be aware of anything but themselves and the food that they pack away in shovels full. Such perfect content, such harmony, such mutual understanding. It drives Van Norden crazy to watch them, especially when she slips her hand in the big fellow's fly and caresses it, to which he generally responds by grabbing her teat and squeezing it playfully. There is another couple who arrive usually about the same time, and they behave just like two married people. They have their spats, they wash their linen in public, and after they've made things disagreeable for themselves and everybody else, after threats and curses and reproaches and recriminations, they make up for it by billing and cooing, just like a pair of turtle doves. Lucienne, as he calls her, is a heavy platinum blonde with a cruel, saturnine air. She has a full underlip, which she chews venomously when her temper runs away with her, and a cold, beady eye, a sort of faded china blue, which makes him sweat when she fixes him with it. But she's a good sort, Lucienne, despite the condor-like profile which she presents to us when the squabbling begins. Her bag is always full of dough, and if she deals it out cautiously, it is only because she doesn't want to encourage him in his bad habits. He has a weak character. That is, if one takes Lucienne's tirade seriously. He will spend 50 francs of an evening while waiting for her to get through. When the waitress comes to take his order, he has no appetite. Ah, you're not hungry again, growls Lucienne. You were waiting for me, I suppose, on the Faubourg Montmartre. You had a good time, I hope, while I slave for you. Speak, imbecile, where were you? When she flares up like that, when she gets enraged, he looks up at her timidly, and then, as if he had decided that silence was the best course, he lets his head drop and he fiddles with his napkin. But this little gesture, which he knows so well, and which of course is secretly pleasing to her, because she is convinced now that he is guilty, only increases Lucienne's anger. Speak, imbecile, she shrieks. And with a squeaky, timid little voice, he explains to her woefully that while waiting for her, he got so hungry that he was obliged to stop off for a sandwich and a glass of beer. It was just enough to ruin his appetite, he says it dolefully, though it's apparent that food just now is the least of his worries. But, and he tries to make his voice sound more convincing, I was waiting for you all the time, he blurts out. Liar, she screams. Liar! Ah, fortunately, I too am a liar, a good liar. You make me ill with your petty little lies. Why don't you tell me a big lie? He hangs his head again, and absent-mindedly, he gathers a few crumbs and puts them to his mouth, whereupon she slaps his hand. Don't do that. You make me tired. You're such an imbecile. Liar. You just wait. I have more to say. I am a liar too, but I am not an imbecile. In a little while, however, they are sitting close together, their hands locked, and she is murmuring softly, Ah, my little rabbit, it is hard to leave you now. Come here, kiss me. What are you going to do this evening? Tell me the truth, my little one. I am sorry that I have such an ugly temper. He kisses her timidly, just like a little bunny with long pink ears, gives her a little peck on the lips, as if he were nibbling a cabbage leaf. And at the same time, his bright round eyes fall caressingly on her purse, which is lying open beside her on the bench. He is only waiting for the moment when he can graciously give her the slip. He is itching to get away, to sit down in some quiet café on the Rue du Faubourg Montmartre. I know him, the innocent little devil, with his round, frightened eyes of a rabbit. And I know what a devil's street is the Faubourg Montmartre, with its brass plates and rubber goods, the lights twinkling all night, and sex running through the street like a sewer. To walk from the Rue Lafayette to the boulevard is like running the gauntlet. They attach themselves to you like barnacles. They eat into you like ants. They coax, wheedle, cajole, implore, beseech. They try it out in German, English, Spanish. They show you their torn hearts and their busted shoes. And long after you've chopped the tentacles away, long after the fizz and sizzle has died out, the fragrance of the lavabo clings to your nostrils. It is the odor of the Parfum de Danse, whose effectiveness is guaranteed only for a distance of 20 centimeters. One could piss away a whole lifetime in that little stretch between the boulevard and the Rue Lafayette. Every bar is alive, throbbing, the dice loaded. The cashiers are perched like vultures on their high stools, and the money they handle has a human stink to it. There's no equivalent in the Banque de France for the blood money that passes currency here, the money that glistens with human sweat, that passes like a forest fire from hand to hand, and leaves behind it a smoke and stench. A man who can walk through the Faubourg Montmartre at night without panting or sweating, without a prayer or a curse on his lips. A man like that has no balls, and if he has, then he ought to be castrated. Supposing the timid little rabbit does spend 50 francs of an evening while waiting for his Lucienne. Supposing he does get hungry and buy a sandwich and a glass of beer, or stop and chat with somebody else's trollop. You think he ought to be weary of that round, night after night? You think it ought to weigh on him, oppress him, bore him to death? You don't think that a pimp is inhuman, I hope. A pimp has his private grief and misery too, don't you forget. Perhaps he would like nothing better than to stand on the corner every night with a pair of white dogs and watch them piddle. Perhaps he would like it if, when he opened the door, he would see her there reading the Paris Soir, her eyes already a little heavy with sleep. Perhaps it isn't so wonderful when he bends over his Lucienne to taste another man's breath. Better maybe to have only 3 francs in your pocket and a pair of white dogs that piddle on the corner than to taste those bruised lips. Bet you, when she squeezes him tight, when she begs for that little package of love which only he knows how to deliver, bet you he fights like 1,000 devils to pump it up, to wipe out that regiment that has marched between her legs. Maybe when he takes her body and practices a new tune, maybe it isn't all passion and curiosity with him, but a fight in the dark, a fight single-handed against the army that rushed the gates, the army that walked over her, trampled her, that left her with such a devouring hunger that not even a Rudolph Valentino could appease. When I listen to the reproaches that are leveled against a girl like Lucienne, when I hear her being denigrated or despised because she is cold and mercenary, because she is too mechanical, or because she is in too great a hurry, or because this, or because that, I say to myself, hold on there, Bozo, not so fast. Remember that you're far back in the procession. Remember that a whole army corps has laid siege to her, that she's been laid waste, plundered, and pillaged. I say to myself, listen, Bozo, don't begrudge the 50 francs you hand her, because you know her pimp is pissing it away in the Faubourg Montmartre. It's her money, and her pimp. It's blood money. It's money that'll never be taken out of circulation, because there's nothing in the Banque de France to redeem it with. End of side 8.